listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot going on, actually. It's summer. Things are supposed to be dead, but it's like a lot going on. But anyhow, welcome to Anything Goes Summer. It is Tuesday, if my sense of, Tuesday, the 9th of July. Two states. Now, we have, I've been saying for some time that the next big bubble that's going to burst, although they're reinflating the housing bubble now and the stock market bubble is at an all-time high, but that the next big bubble that I think might burst could be the student loan bubble. $1 trillion in student loans. Something that pretty much never existed in the history of this country. You've got an entire generation that is starting their lives as indentured servants, functionally. Many of them believe they can't afford to get married. Actually, many of them probably can't afford to get married, although I would submit, speaking as somebody who got married at a fairly young age, that, you know, you can work that through. But having children, that's a tough one. Although that's sometimes the unintended consequence of getting married, or even not, but still. But perhaps more important, the major way that the middle class in the United States builds wealth is by owning homes. When my dad died back in 2006, his house had been paid off for nearly a decade. That was his wealth. I mean, it wasn't a lot. I think my brother sold that house for around $80,000 or $90,000, but that, you know, compared to my dad bought it for $13,000 back in the 50s, so pretty good deal. But that, you know, that was his wealth, that you could build wealth by buying a house when you were young. And my dad bought that house, and it was the second house, by the way, that he owned. The first house that he had owned was considerably smaller. I still remember it. It was when I was much smaller. But he was able to do that because my dad, you know, he joined the Army during World War II. It ended by the time he got out of boot camp, so he went off to Japan as part of the occupation forces. But when he came back, he was eligible for the GI Bill, thanks to Franklin Roosevelt and the continuation of that by Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. And so he was able to go to college and even get a stipend. He was paid to go to college. And when he dropped out of college, because my mom got pregnant with me, and he went to work in a steel mill, and he was looking for a house to buy, the federal government was backstopping homes. As one of the veterans' benefits, they would help you buy a house. And he did. Now, if he had had $50,000 or $100,000 or even $5,000 or $10,000 in student loan debt, he probably wouldn't have been able to come up with a down payment for the house. He might not have been creditworthy for it. Well, I'm using my dad's example. I'd say probably, you know, I don't know the percentage, three quarters, half, a large chunk of the, quote, wealth that Louise and I have is because, you know, we started buying our own houses. Now, of course, the bank owned them for the first three quarters of our married life, but over time, equity built and built and built, and we started buying our own houses in our late 20s. And now we own our houses, and that's a good chunk of our wealth. And we were able to do that because neither one of us had student loan debt. So what you basically have is an entire generation of young people who can't even begin the process of building the wealth that would allow them to have a decent retirement, or allow them to have a buffer against, you know, some assets against which they could borrow if they have rough times, if they lose their job, if somebody gets sick. This used to be fundamentally and frankly the core of the middle class. And President Obama said, you know, student loan rate, it's only 3.4%. Let's keep it there. But Republicans in Congress said, no, we're going to let it double. So it's now 6.8%. It doubled. And on top of that, you've got over $1 trillion in student loan. This is insane. Now, Oregon and New Jersey are trying to do something about it. They're putting into place, you know, legislation, or they're attempting to put into place legislation, where basically you can go to the state schools for free to very little. You run up some debt, but you can pay that debt off in a variety of ways if you stay in the state and you're working in particular industries. And, you know, I mean, the laws vary and they're still being negotiated, but why even that? You know, before Ronnie Reagan became governor, California's education was free. Abraham Lincoln took millions of acres of public land and gave it away to establish over 50 land-grant colleges in virtually all the states, where the state had enough land for that college that they could work that land, whether it was a farm or whether it was lumber or whatever it was, and earn enough money from that land that they could offer free tuition to the citizens of their state. And they did. If you want to go back farther than Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson was so proud of the fact that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, America's first free college, that when he designed his tombstone, and he wrote his own, and he designed the graphics for his own tombstone, the words that he put on there was that he was the author of the Virginia Declaration of Religious Liberties, the author of the Declaration of Independence, and the founder of the University of Virginia. This is a guy who was president of the United States twice, who was Secretary of State. None of that stuff was as important as the fact that he started a free college. This is mind-boggling. And I am predicting that at some point, this generation of 20-somethings and 30-somethings who have been saddled with this debt as a consequence of 30 years of Reaganomics, Reagan's war. I mean, you know, everybody knows about Reagan's war on working people, on unions and on, you know, on the minimum wage and all that kind of thing. Less well known is Reagan's war on young people. When he became governor of California, the University of California system was free. And he called the young people who were out in the streets demonstrating against the Vietnam War punks. And said, why should I have to pay with my taxes for them to go out and demonstrate my policies? And he began the dismantling of free college education in California as governor and in the United States as president. Those of you in your 20s and 30s and even 40s listening to this program may be hard to believe, but back in the 50s and 60s and 70s in the United States, back before the Reagan presidency, if you had the brain power to go to college, or the brain power and the inclination to go to good trade school, the unions provided apprenticeships and trade schools for free. You could get the kind of education you needed. So anyhow, I find that absolutely mind-boggling when that two states, Oregon and New Jersey, even need to do this. Meanwhile, the Koch brothers are running ads saying Obamacare is going to take away your choice of doctor. Hey, really? No, it's not in the law. And the Chicago Fed. Remember back in 2013 in the Obama State of the Union, earlier this year in the Obama State of the Union address, he said, let's raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, which is a dollar below where it would be if you just inflation adjusted from the 60s, the minimum wage. He said, let's raise it to $9 an hour. The Chicago Fed that says that would increase total household spending $50 billion the next year. Huge stimulus. Republicans aren't going to allow that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nope, they want the economy to be as bad as it can as long as you've got a Democratic president in the White House, particularly this Democrat. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Shano, can you pull the audio off my computer here? This is an absolutely epic rant. This is a young woman. You know, Texas is kind of slow walking their anti-woman bill. It contains a provision that reduces from 24 to 20 weeks the number of weeks when a person can get an abortion. But the larger part of it would close down a whole bunch of clinics that offer things like preventative cancer exams, prenatal care, just a whole variety, actually, of women's services. And this young woman gets, can you say that again? Yeah, it's FCC friendly. There's no swear words in this. And this young woman has, you know, and people have signed up to testify, and this young woman is giving testimony, and this is just, Daily Kos has it up. Wow, young woman has epic rant on Texas abortion hearings, gets hauled off by state troopers. As I said, this is not just about abortion. This is about women's health rights. And here's what she had to say.
Chair and committee, my name is Sarah Slaman. I'm constituent of Senator Whitmire. I'm here to testify against SB1 because I'm tired of Republican primary politics, misogyny, and greed dominating the state I was born, raised, and schooled in. And, you know, I had some really eloquent remarks written out, but you guys have just worn me down all day with all this terrible science and glad-handing. And to be frank, I get to move to New York next month, so I don't have to live in fear of you Texas legislators anymore and what you're going to do to my education system or my health care system, because I'm going to a state that doesn't kill its own inmates. That's how pro-life it is up there. I will thank you, though, first. It was destiny that you would discriminate against us and try to force your way inside the bodies of Texas women. Thank you for finally working against us women so publicly and not in the shadows like you're used to. Thank you for every single bad press conference with your bad information. Thank you for every hateful statement degrading women and girls to sex objects and broodmares and bald eagles and leather wallets like your eloquent pro-life supporters have done today. Thank you for being you, Texas legislature. You have radicalized hundreds of thousands of us. And no matter what you do for the next 22 days, women and their allies are coming for you. Let's start down the line. Senator Campbell, you're an ophthalmologist, so I won't be making you the expert on reproductive health. We can give you all the children with chlamydia and herpes in their eyes since we don't have sex ed in this state. And Senator Hagar?
Now, at this point, and then she goes to the senator who's, like, chairing the committee. She's calling out the names of the people who are sitting in front of her. And at that point, the Texas police show up and lift her out of her chair, and you will hear her being hauled off as she's speaking. How dare you address one of the people who is interrogating?
You're about as helpful. You are about as... Excuse me. This is my government, ma'am. I will judge you. I will judge you, ma'am. Is this counting against my time?
Yes, it is.
The senator talking against me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, I will just go ahead and talk over her. And this is how big of a fraud I knew you were for being so proud of these proceedings all night. It's a low bar that you hold yourself to that you simply allowed us to speak. And I will speak against an ophthalmologist who says, everyone on the internet can see what you're doing right now. This is a farce.
She's being hauled out.
The Texas legislators, a bunch of liars who hate women.
Our next witness is Gary Oldham.
There you go. And she was hauled off. It's amazing. It's amazing. And it may well be true what she's saying, that women across America, I mean, it's like the Republican, that women across America are being radicalized. The Republicans are saying in the states that were covered by the Voting Rights Act, you know, the Voting Rights Act prevented them from immediately introducing gerrymandering and voter suppression laws. And literally the week, you know, the day after, actually, Texas did it the day after, within a week, six or seven of these states have now introduced voter suppression laws, and gerrymandering. I mean, they're doing it. They're going to make it harder and harder and harder for people of color and poor people and young people and elderly people to vote, because those people are more likely to vote Democratic. But they haven't figured out, or perhaps they have, they haven't figured out yet a way to stop women from voting. And with now, when I said perhaps they have, you know, the thought occurred to me, my mom, who was a stay-at-home mom, didn't, you know, she let her driver's license lapse when she was in her late 20s, early 30s, when my when my third brother, you know, I have three younger brothers. When my second or third younger brother came along, that we were all born within 2 years of each other. It was 2 years, 3 years, and 2 years. And, you know, it just reached a point where she was like, you know, we only have one car. And, you know, Dad drives it to work. And, you know, I don't need a car. I don't need a driver's license. And she never drove again. And she didn't have a driver's license. Although she did vote. In fact, she was one of those volunteers who sat at the table and registered and, you know, checked the book and, you know, for when people voted. But she would not be able to vote in Michigan under these new laws. So on the one hand, maybe Republicans have even figured out a way to suppress the women's vote. On the other hand, that was the 50s and 60s and 70s. And back then, before Reaganomics, before 32 years of Reaganomics had devastated the working class in America, a family with one person with a good full-time union job could raise a family, buy a new car every couple of years, pay off their house, have full health insurance, take a vacation for a week or two every year, put their kids through school. I mean, all of those things are true of my dad, who worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. And so Mom didn't have to work. She didn't want to work. She didn't have to work. She did work, actually. She worked her butt off raising four boys. It's arguably much harder work than what my dad did. But the point is that on the one hand, the Republicans would succeed in suppressing her vote today. But on the other hand, there's not that many stay-at-home moms anymore. Half of all kids come home to an empty house because 32 years of Republican policies have pretty much destroyed the idea of a single-worker household. So we'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm wondering, do you think that the war on women, the Republican war on women, is going to backfire and is going to bring women out for the midterm election, the 2014 election? It's your media support group for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with rationality and the occasional fact. Just a couple of quickies here. It's anything goes summer, so and we've got a board full of calls. I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second, but just some very, very quick things. Nikki Haley, the Republican right-wing crazy governor of South Carolina, has been going off on why they have to have voter suppression laws in that state that make it harder for people who don't have ID to vote, people, older people who no longer own cars, no longer drive, people like my mother, young people, students who haven't yet bought a car, don't have a driver's license, or have an out-of-state driver's license and don't want to re-register in the state, even though they're, you know, et cetera. Poor people, people who live in big cities, they take mass transportation, public transportation. You know, I haven't driven a car other than a rental car last weekend. I haven't driven a car in almost 3 years. And, you know, my driver's license expires sometime, I think, on my birthday next year. And, you know, I have the time. I make a decent salary. I have the time. I can take a day off work. I have the time to go get it replaced. But if I was, you know, just getting by and working at McDonald's and I could take the subway here, the metro here in Washington, D.C. to do so, I probably wouldn't renew it, which means I wouldn't be able to vote in a lot of places in South Carolina. In South Carolina, Nikki Haley has said, we need to spend millions and millions of dollars putting into place these voter suppression ID laws because dead people are voting. Well, they did the study, and sure enough, this is the taxpayers of South Carolina paid for the study. It was done by the State Law Enforcement Division. And they were tasked with the job of finding even one zombie voter. Is it worth spending tens of millions of dollars to stop one phony voter from voting? Yes, of course it is, says Nikki Haley. They couldn't find one. Todd Rutherford is the House Democratic leader there. He is now requesting respectfully that Nikki Haley, the governor, the Republican governor of South Carolina, apologize to the voters for wasting millions of dollars. He says, we now have the proof that shows that the accusations of voter fraud are completely without merit. And once again, South Carolina's taxpayers have to foot the bill for the millions of dollars unnecessarily spent as a result of Governor Haley and her colleagues' incompetence and blind ideology. She should apologize. She should acknowledge that they were being dishonest about voter fraud and apologize to the public. So if you live in South Carolina, you might want to call Nikki Haley's office and say, hey, how about that apology? Is it coming? Moral Monday yesterday in North Carolina, in Raleigh. Best protest ever. Best protest signs ever. Stop the looting. Austerity politics are a fraud based on a spreadsheet error. Here's one. I see the problem. You have Republicans in your vagina. Shop Stewart, protect voting rights. There's some funny ones here. There's some that you can't read on the radio. This one says, don't frack me, bro. It's a good one. Protect voting rights. GOP protecting the rights of rich white men. Yeah, surprise, surprise. Reverend Barber, who is on this program. We're going to have to get Reverend Barber back on the program. He's doing some great stuff there. And finally, the Washington Post was reporting yesterday, or the New York Times, excuse me. I read the story yesterday afternoon on the subway, that that President Obama is getting really, really upset with Hamid Karzai. And he's saying, you know, this guy, all he does is, you know, kick me upside the head. He's yelling. I'm paraphrasing wildly here, obviously. But, you know, Karzai literally takes suitcases full of cash. That's how he wants to be paid. He gets suitcases full of cash every week from the U.S. Embassy and passes that cash out. And he complains he doesn't get enough. He's getting millions. This is the second poorest country in the world. They had, before we started bombing them, before George Bush started bombing them, their economy was a $2 billion a year economy. With a B, $2 billion. That's less than most states in the United States. It's the second poorest country in the world. We now spend $14 billion a year just propping up the government. We are their GDP now. Not to mention the $1 trillion that we've spent destroying things and killing people and hopefully, theoretically, rebuilding some of them. So anyhow, President Obama is now saying, you know, maybe screw them. We're out of here by the end of next year. Residual force? No, don't think so. Zero. We're going to go to zero. For that, I have two words, cautionary words. I mean, I agree with, if this is the president's thinking, I agree with it, whether it's his thinking or not. I don't think that I'm with George Washington, avoid foreign entanglements. But my two words are Charlie Wilson. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up. Rusty in New York, New York. Hey, Rusty, what's up?
Hey, how are you today?
I am fine. Thanks for watching Manhattan Neighborhood Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you. Well, unfortunately, you had me on hold for so long, I kind of almost forgot what I was going to talk
about. It says you're still
paying
off your student loans.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. I think, well, but then you started talking about Texas, though, too.
Yeah.
What were you saying about that? You played that video, that lady, which I had seen also.
Yeah.
And what were you saying about that again, too? Because then I kind of got off on the tangent with that, and I was going to talk to you something about that.
Okay, well, pick a tangent, Rusty, because I got a whole bunch of other people who'd like to get in here, too. So pick a topic and go for it.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you think is more important right now. Because for me, student loans, but I think a woman should be able to do what she wants with her body in Texas, too. But I don't know.
So on the student loan thing, your opinion on student loans, since you live in New York.
Yeah. What was I going to say about that?
You're still paying off your student loans after 10 years?
Yeah, but I had a point I was going to make about it.
Okay.
Because I'm having trouble paying them, but because of there's some law.
Law was the Bankruptcy Reform Act that was passed, as I recall, in 2005 or 2006. And it used to be that when you declared bankruptcy, the only thing that you couldn't declare bankruptcy on, that you couldn't walk away from, was your taxes. And the IRS would even renegotiate your taxes with you. But now, in their infinite wisdom, and there were a few Democrats that went along with this, but it was mostly Republicans, they passed a law that said that when you declare bankruptcy, you may not declare bankruptcy on your student loans. And that's when the banks really started making serious money and started selling derivatives on student loans. And that's why that's the next big bubble. Rusty, thanks for the call. Gerald in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Since we have a do-nothing Congress that hadn't been able to get anything passed, and it seems like forever.
Yep.
I mean, they can't even name a building after somebody, you know, without an argument about it.
Well, anymore. They did decide the size of the what was it, the NBA memorial coins or the NFL or whatever. They decided memorial coins, yeah.
Yeah, they waste so much time when we got real problems in this country.
Oh, and the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House have voted 37 times, each one initiated by Michelle Bachmann to eliminate Obamacare and so that if you have a pre-existing condition, your insurance company can throw you off their coverage.
Yeah, the whole thing is, I was going to say, since they're doing nothing, President Obama could issue a bunch of executive decisions, and they would be basically, I think, the way the Constitution is, they'd be law until Congress negated them.
No, that's not quite how it works. Yeah, Gerald, the in short form, the way that it works is all spending and taxing authority rests with the House of Representatives and then has to be ratified by the Senate and then signed by the President. So the creation of all federal agencies, which fall under the executive branch, they technically work for the President, the EPA, OSHA, the National Labor Relations Board, all those agencies, those also have to be created and then funded by Congress. So the President's power with regard to executive orders is very, very limited. He can take an existing agency and he can move money around in that agency as long as the way that the money is spent has not been stipulated by Congress. He can, for example, one of the things he said that he was going to do is he was going to tell the EPA that they can start regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Well, that actually went to the Supreme Court about 5 or 6 years ago, and the Supreme Court said, yes, it's a pollutant, and yes, the president can do that. But he doesn't have money. I mean, he would have to say to the EPA, you're going to have to take some of those inspectors who are looking for sulfur dioxide and have them looking for carbon dioxide instead because the Congress won't give him the money. The problem is with a do-nothing Congress, I mean, it was quite wise, really, the founders saying we're going to keep power as close to the people as possible. The House of Representatives is elected every 2 years, so they're the closest to the people. But, you know, they didn't anticipate that there would be billionaires in the United States who would buy off large swaths of the American House of Representatives, to the point where every single freshman Republican now says there's no such thing as global warming, so the Koch brothers should be free to dump all the pollutants in the atmosphere they want, for example. So go ahead.
I just wanted him to do some of those, any executive order he could do to make it better.
I agree.
And then that might spur Congress into actually doing something.
It would probably spur them into trying to impeach him because they're absolutely committed. I mean, they had this meeting the night that he was inaugurated at the Caucus Room restaurant on January 20th, 2008. They had a meeting where they, or 2009, they had a meeting where they swore to each other, these 15 Republicans, including Paul Ryan, that they would do everything they could to block and obstruct his policies. In fact, they referred to it as a Taliban philosophy. So I would love to see him using the bully pulpit. I'd love to see him getting more outraged, but he's not.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But that said, we have to be realistic about the power he has. Franklin Roosevelt had overwhelming majorities in both the House and Senate. Barack Obama has neither. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, you wanted to talk about the NFL. They are not supporting Obamacare. They're not going to do any public service announcements telling people to sign up for the exchanges.
Well, I'll tell you, they ought to be ashamed of themselves, and they ought to be ashamed of how they treat their former players who've got injuries and disabilities.
Brain injuries,
all
in particular.
Yeah. They're not doing a very good job, and you know, keeping people on policies, just kids till they're 26 on their parents' things. There's no jobs in this country. They've been outsourced and stuff, and they need a safety net, and it's outrageous. One thing we got to do, I want to talk about Goodell here a little bit, but I'm tired of people calling the Congress do nothing. It's wrong. I wish they'd stop saying that. What they need to say is call it what it is. It's the Republican-controlled do-nothing Congress.
Right. Or the Republican-controlled obstruct anything that might help America Congress.
Exactly. And Obama better get with it. He better start calling a spade and calling out his people like FDR and Truman did, because if he doesn't, it's going to make it tough on the Democrats in future elections, and not only on the Democrats, the 99% of the people here. But anyways, a little bit about Goodell here. Roger Goodell's father, he was Republican Senator Charles Goodell from New York.
Mm-hmm.
This was years ago, so there's maybe a little bit of.
So who's Roger Goodell? Forgive my ignorance.
Yeah, Roger Goodell.
Who is he?
His father, Roger Goodell's father, was Charles Goodell. He was Republican former senator from New York. Okay.
Okay, but who is Roger Goodell? If he has to do with sports,
oh,
I just don't know.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Roger Goodell is the NFL commissioner.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes there's a little delay when we talk, and I don't hear you, so I apologize.
No, that's quite all right.
Okay. He's also, Tom, he's married to, a lot of people might know this person, maybe not, but her name is Jane Skinner, and she's a former Fox News anchor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so kind of coincidence there. Now, also, the story gets further interesting. Her father is Sam Skinner, and he's the former transportation secretary and the White House chief of staff under President George H.W. Bush. So we got a lot of Republicanism there, and you know.
It's like a ruling royal family, you know?
Totally.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I just kind of wanted to share that with you and all that, and, you know, I wish Obamacare would go a little bit further, more like the Canadian system, you know.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a heck of a system, and we could learn a lot.
And they could have done it so simply just by putting a public option in there, but they didn't. But I suspect that when 2016 comes and those waivers are available, that it's going to start with Vermont and Montana, and you're going to see states start single-payer systems, and all of a sudden, literally, the cost of health care is going to cut in half in those states, and you're going to see other states going, whoa, we can save some money, and you're going to see some voters saying, we can save some money, and it's going to roll across this country the same way it did when it started in Saskatchewan back in the 50s or 60s. Steve, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. I did not know that about the NFL commissioner. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? By the way, on the waivers, before I get that snow and everything, on the waivers, my understanding that it won't be until 2017 they can get those waivers, and I'm a little bit cynical that they will be granted, because even if they are granted in 2016, that's an election year, and I don't know if the federal government's going to be too much in favor of granting waivers in the middle of an election year for a Canadian-style healthcare system. But
we will see.
Anyway, on Ed Stoughton and they're saying the Fourth Amendment,
mm-hmm.
It's funny, you had all these conservatives calling yesterday who were so worried about the Second Amendment, and yet the rights we really have under attack by the government, in my opinion, are the Fourth Amendment rights that we're supposedly all guaranteed. And thank God for people like Ed Snowden. And as far as I'm concerned, by him revealing what the NSA is doing with respect to our Fourth Amendment rights being violated, Ed Snowden, to me, is to civil liberties what Rosa Parks was and is to civil rights. Because just as Rosa Parks engaged in civil disobedience and was accused of breaking the law and arrested, even though, in my opinion, the real law breakers were the Southern segregationists who tried to deny Rosa Parks her civil and equal rights under the U.S. Constitution. Well, I think Ed Snowden, in my opinion, he's engaged in a type of civil disobedience, and he's also been accused of breaking the law and threatened with arrest over his release of classified information.
It's a very interesting metaphor, Jerry. I think that there are some significant differences, but I still think it's an interesting analogy. Thank you, Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You asked about, do you think the Republicans have found a way to keep women from voting?
Mm-hmm.
They certainly figured out a way to make it harder.
How's that?
Men typically never change their names throughout the course of their lives.
Right.
Women, still, many of them, when they get married, change their names or hyphenate the name.
Right, so that means they need a whole brand new set of ID.
Right, and then now that they're saying, oh, you bring in your birth certificate, now you got to bring in your marriage certificate. Then if you get divorced and change your name, how many people go running to the DMV and voter registration first thing after they get married or divorced to change their name?
Right.
Enough that way. Wisconsin, our driver's license is good for 8 years.
So your driver's license may be a different name than your actual legal name, because why go change your driver's license if the only thing you're using it for is to vote in terms of your real name?
Or even, you know, there's no requirement that you have to change it right away.
Right, right.
That's going to be where they're going to disenfranchise women. You know, you get married a month or two before an election, you're not thinking about, oh, I got to go get a new ID and I have to update my voter registration.
Right, you're toast. Margie, thank you. I was trying to figure out how the Republicans would disenfranchise women. I mean, you know, poor people, people of color, elderly people, students, that's all fairly obvious. But women, thank you. You have educated me. I appreciate the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, hour two. And we were going to have Davin Michael on. Michael's on, the founder of 123 Employee and the author of Outsource Smart. His website, davinmichaels.com, DAVENMICHAELS. But we found some guy in the Philippines who would do the same segment for only $1 an hour. He sounds a lot like Davin Michaels, though. Is that Ricardo?
Hello, Tom. It's Ricardo here. How are you?
Fine. Davin, you have written a book telling American business people, entrepreneurs, particularly small businesses, that they could just say, to hell with American labor, let's find some guy in the Philippines to do the job.
You got it. Exactly.
Seriously?
Well, absolutely. Listen, Tom, there's plenty of jobs that need to be done here in the U.S., skilled labor. But if somebody, you know, if somebody's out there that has a job right now, maybe they're doing telemarketing at a call center, they're doing client support, customer service, they're in trouble. And it's time for them to get new skills. There's plenty of information available today. There's so much, the wealth of our world.
Get new skills like what?
Whatever it is.
I mean, go back to school and become a brain surgeon. The AMA actually limits the number of doctors there are, so we're importing doctors now.
Somebody can start a business today within a couple of days. They come up with an idea. They put a website up on the Internet, throw some traffic towards it.
They come up with some money.
Actually, it's not expensive. When I first started my first business, I probably invested about $100,000 because back then everything had to be brick and mortar. Today,
$100,000 is a hell of a lot of money, Davin. You've got, you know, the average total wealth of the average white American family in the United States is around $80,000. Average African American family is around $6,000. And that was before the big crash. A lot of those numbers are now negative.
That's right. But today, Tom, somebody can put a website up for a couple $100, throw a little traffic towards it for a couple $100, test it out, see if it flies, and then over time ramp it up.
But putting a website up and getting people to go to that website are two completely different things, as you well know. I mean,
Absolutely. We do it all the time. We come up with ideas all the time, and then we drive some traffic to it. We see if it flies. If it flies, we grow that business. If it doesn't, we move on to the next one. We do it all the time.
For example?
When I come up with new books, I come up with new concepts, new events that I'm going to do, or information products I'm going to create. We first create the website. We throw it up on the web. We do a little test. We see if it converts.
So do you do this thing? There was this must have been 3 decades ago. This was back when you read, you know, and they had ads in the back of comic books. And they had this ad that said, you can make thousands of dollars in your spare time using direct mail. Send $5 and we will send you the instructions. Mm-hmm. And I was a gullible 14-year-old. I had a paper route. Grit was the paper. And I saved up my $5 and I sent it off. And what they sent me was an instruction sheet that said, buy an ad in the back of a comic book that says you can make money in your spare time, just send $5, and you will get thousands of people sending you $5, and you'll make a lot of money.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know,
is that the kind of thing that you're doing?
Well, in a way, I suppose it is, because today we use the internet instead of direct mail. It's much quicker, it's less expensive, and it's immediate.
It sounds like a scam, Davin.
But it's not. People are doing it all day long. I mean, let's face it, all commerce is done on the internet today.
Well, not all commerce. People still go to stores.
All commerce. You know what? If we go to a store, how do we find out that store? We go on the internet to find out where that store is located. All commerce goes back to the internet today. If somebody's going to walk into your donut shop, the way they're going to find you, they're either going to drive by or they're going to look it up online. Everything is online. And if somebody has a brick-and-mortar business, whether they think they're an online marketer or not, they have to be doing something.
So what does this have to do with outsourcing American jobs?
Sure. Well, today, entrepreneurs will source their goods and services from wherever it makes the most sense. It's not the 50s anymore. The borders are gone. We can do business anywhere we want, and that's because of the internet. So entrepreneurs.
Well, it's not just because of the internet. The borders were gone. You know, they started disintegrating. Nixon started the whole idea of most favored nation status, trade status. Reagan put it on steroids, and then Bill Clinton in the 90s, and this was the, you know, probably only half of America at that point even had access to the internet. Passed WTO, GATT, NAFTA, you know, and made transnational corporations sovereign over the United States. This has been a long time coming. This is, you know, the internet is following in the back of it. But what's wrong with countries having borders? What's wrong with, you know, when George Washington had Alexander Hamilton come up with his 11-point plan for American manufacturers in 1791 or 1793, it you know, built this country. And you know, they started with tariffs. We've had average 35% tariffs from the time of the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration, and it built an enormous industrial nation. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, you know, as you know, Tom, women are voting now too. But
what does this have to do with what does this have to do with women?
It's 2013, Tom, and today with the internet, we can, again, we access all the
wealth. So something that worked for 200 years, we should ignore and throw away because women can vote?
Tom, today we are only going to work, we are only going to source our goods and services from where it makes the most sense.
Let's go back to those rules that said if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Connecticut that you want to sell on your website.
We put up borders, an iPhone would cost over $2,000.
And you want to make that pair of shoes in China where it's five cents worth of labor. There'll be a 95-cent tax when you import it. If you want to make it in Mexico, there's 50 cents worth of labor in that pair of shoes. There's a 50-cent tax when you import it so that the cost of labor is equalized so that employers no longer have an incentive to send jobs overseas. What's wrong with doing that?
It's just not going to happen. Now, I'll tell you what is going to happen, though, is manufacturing is actually going to come back to the U.S. I guarantee over the next 5 to 10 years, it's all coming back for two reasons.
At $8 an hour.
No, actually, it's going to come back for two reasons. One is robots. The robots are getting more and more sophisticated, so manufacturing is definitely coming back to the U.S. And then in addition to that, they're coming back to the U.S. I lost my train of thought there for a second.
Well, that's okay. But what you're saying basically is manufacturing jobs are not coming back to the United States unless they pay squat. I'm just curious, where do you think, A, do you think that having a middle class in the United States is a good thing? And B, if so, how are you going to get that? Because what you're talking about is basically laissez-faire economics. It is the way that England ran their economic system during the time of Charles Dickens. And what that produces invariably, and this experiment has been done literally hundreds of times over centuries in dozens and dozens of countries, and what that produces is a very small, very wealthy class, a very small middle class, that's the store owners and you know, Scrooge and Marley, you know, they had a one-employee business. He was a small businessman. That was the middle class. And then you have this huge class made up of over 95% of all the people who are the working poor. And that's the kind of world that your economics is going to create. And frankly, the policies that you're espousing are creating in the United States. Is that what you want?
No, I disagree. I believe that solopreneurs and entrepreneurs are actually the fuel that will actually bring
that's back the middle class. That's that small number of people who can actually, you know, who have the ability, the money, the smarts, the technology, whatever, to run a business. I'm with you on that. But if you're saying that the entire middle class of the United States is going to be entrepreneurs, that's going to be what? 2% of America? 3% of America?
It'll be entrepreneurs and more skilled labor, higher skilled.
Okay,
than
a skill. Name a skill for me that somebody who just, you know, says Sensata, I think, is the company. Mitt Romney owned this company in Ohio. They shipped every bricks and everything over to China. Those workers used to know how to do precision machine tools. Now they know nothing that they can sell. What skills should they acquire to become part of America's middle class?
I would definitely consider precision machine tooling to be a highly skilled job.
It is, but it's no longer done in the United States.
Well, it is done by some companies in the U.S.
Very, very, very few. I have some personal knowledge of this. My dad worked in the tool and die industry for 40 years. They, you know, when Reagan came in, the job started going to Italy. Now they're going to Korea, Japan, and China.
Yeah, but how can we possibly put up borders? It's not possible. It's impossible
sure
to put up borders.
You do it with tax law. We have 22,000 tariffs on the books right now. Most of them are set at less than 2%. You set them back to 25, 30, 35% like they used to be before Reagan and Clinton. Anyhow, we're out of time. Davin Michaels, Outsource Smart is his book. Davin Michaels, DavinMichaels.com. The website, he's the founder of 123 Employee. Davin, thanks for dropping by. Hello? Yeah, good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so is this the future of the middle class? That we all become entrepreneurs? Hey, I'll sell to you if you'll sell to me. I don't think so. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is GE a person? Is United Coal a person? Is BP a person? Supreme Court says yes. I say they're crazy. Rich in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Rich, thanks for listening to 760 AM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, always a pleasure. Awesome show. You do a yeoman's work there. I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what Steve said about the NFL and stuff. Here's another thing, and I find that ironic that Goodell's wife used to work for a fake news channel.
Yeah, well, let's keep in mind, just because a caller says something doesn't mean that it's true. It may well be true.
No,
but, you know, it's like, on the internet, just because something's there, don't take it to the bank.
I understand, right, that it was on the, right, but it's interesting that the NFL business policy model is based on socialism.
Of course
you
it
know,
is.
They all, you know, share their pie and their resource and everything, and it's, you know, all 38 teams, or 32 teams, excuse me, And I thought that was kind of when he was talking about that.
Yeah, I think, Rich, a lot of people don't know what you're talking about. Let me toss out a couple examples. I'm guessing you probably know more about it. I'm not much of a sports fan, and the only football team that I've ever followed is the Packers. I used to follow the Tigers as a baseball team when I grew up in Michigan, but that's about my limit of sports knowledge, okay? But what I do know is in the NFL, at the end of the year, you've got a couple of teams that you've got a team that is the best and you've got a team that is the worst. And then you got everything in the spectrum in between. And between that time and the next season, they get to pick new players out of the pool of players. And the first picks, presumably the best players, go to the worst teams.
Worst.
And the last picks go to the best teams as a way of,
right.
You know, this would be the equivalent of share the wealth. It would be the equivalent of taxing rich people and giving money to poor people on an economic basis. That's one example of how the NFL is super socialist. I'm assuming you have other examples?
Well, yeah, I mean, just their business principles. They all share the TV contracts, the concessions, the parking.
Do all the teams share that equally?
It's all now. I don't know all of them. I mean, all of the concessions and or the parking contracts and the salaries. You know, obviously the players.
Right.
But I know that the TV revenue takes care of what they get. It was all the teams, and that's all shared by all 32 of the teams.
That's interesting.
So even in a soft market or whatever, or a lesser team. You know, as opposed to the Super Bowl champion team, you know,
right.
It's all into the same.
And this way, they keep all these teams alive, so that the
right.
league can continue to play another
right.
year.
Exactly.
The one thing is that in order to own a team, unless you're the Green Bay Packers, which got grandfathered in, which started out as a team owned by a union at a meatpacking plant, which is why they're called the Packers.
Right.
And the Packers are owned by. at least as of a few years ago. It's gotten a little more liberal. They're owned by their fans. But all the other teams, you basically have to be a millionaire or a billionaire to own a team or own a share of a team. Is that not right?
To get it, exactly. I mean, yeah. It's like a lot of other things, like politics. I mean, you need multi-millions of dollars just to get in and,
right.
you know, to...
And then the other thing that these NFL teams do is they say to towns and cities and states, you know, if you want us to stay here, you're going to build us a brand new stadium at your own expense, and we're going to take all the profits from it. So that's not even socialism. Yeah. That's like, you know, crony capitalism or something. That is internalizing profits and externalizing the expenses.
And then they hold it over, and then exactly, and then they hold it over the city, hijack
right.
the city, and say, "Well, if you won't build us a team, we'll go somewhere else."
Right.
You know, we'll move. You know.
Right, and
I
they
mean,
do.
That's exactly. You know, that's what Los Angeles is trying to get a team, and they're going through the same thing. One quick thing I wanted to say, also, he was talking. I'd like to see President Barack Obama go down to the Senate one night, like LBJ, and start cracking up, you know, knocking heads. Is there
yeah.
any reason why he's not being the more the using the bully pulpit and going along the lines of LBJ and FDR and Truman and stuff? Because it seems to you mean, you know, I volunteered for the guy, I voted for the guy twice, but it seems to me he's just going along to get along. What's your take on? I know you've talked about it extensively
sure.
before, but
I am of two minds about this, Rich, and this is genuinely how I feel and what I'm thinking. On the one hand, I would love to see him calling, you know, taking names and kicking ass. I'd love to see him, like Harry Truman, say, you know, these people, this is a do nothing Congress. These people are lying. You know, I would love to see him calling them out. The one time that he actually even used the word damn in an interview, you know, Drudge has a giant headline. Obama goes street with the darkest picture of him they can find, you know, so they're like, oh, my God, it's the angry black man in the White House. We can't have that. So I realize there's some risk associated with that, but I would still like to see him do that. On the other hand, LBJ, who didn't do that quite so much. I mean, he was more of a backroom negotiator. He didn't do it in public. Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt did it in public. Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt, with the exception of the Congress of 1946, 46 through 48, they had overwhelming Democratic majorities, so they were able to get things done, and they were able to call out the Republicans. And when Harry Truman called out the do-nothing Congress, you know, that Congress, they lost so badly that the Republicans didn't recover the House of Representatives until the 80s, and that was the election of 48, right? And it wasn't until, you know, Newt Gingrich was the first Republican Speaker of the House after Harry Truman's presidency. Truman had inflicted so much damage on them. I would love to see that happen. On the other hand, though, this Republican Party is implacable. They are funded by billionaires in a way that Truman and LBJ and Franklin Roosevelt never even imagined would happen. In fact, it would have been illegal back then. This is all, you know, the Supreme Court made this possible, number one. Number two, so they're funded by billionaires, so they don't care about the political process because they know that some billionaire will run ads and pull their fat out of the fire at the last minute, you know, for their elections. And number two, it used to be that politicians worked together, knew each other, and cared about the country. And I am convinced that the majority of these Republicans who are obstructionists literally do not care about the country. They do not care about what's best for the vast majority of the working people in this country. They only care about the billionaires and multimillionaires who pay their paychecks and the corporations associated with them. And that being the case, Obama would, you know, it would be a fool's errand for him to do it. So, you know, take either one.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And on those occasions when Obama has tried calling them out, it hasn't gone so well. I'd still love to see him do it more. We'll see. So, James Comey, the guy who is the Obama nominee, the Republican, who is the Obama nominee to head up the FBI, he was the guy who drove like a bat out of hell to get to John Ashcroft's bedside when Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez were trying to get there to get Ashcroft to sign off on illegal wiretaps, warrantless wiretaps. Ultimately, Comey succeeded. Ashcroft didn't sign off on it. Ashcroft was in his hospital bed. He was stoned on painkillers. He just had, I think, gallbladder surgery or some very painful surgery. And he was out of it. And Comey got there first and sent Ashcroft and Andy Card on their way back to the White House to tell Bush and Cheney, sorry, guys, the attorney general will not authorize this. So Bush and Cheney just did it anyway. But in any case, Comey has been criticized because when he was the national security advisor, when he was the assistant to John Ashcroft, that, you know, he oversaw some of these things, or at least had some participation in an administration that was involved in waterboarding. In his testimony today, he came out and he said, I was opposed to waterboarding. I thought it was illegal torture. It just, he was not in a position to stop it. It was not his. Now, he could have resigned. He could have made a stink. He didn't. He was a good German. But, you know, you could argue that this doesn't rise to the level of the Holocaust, you know, over which somebody should resign. Or you could argue that, you know, hey, this is, so we'll see. It's going to be argued in Congress. But he said, James B. Comey said during a confirmation hearing that while he authorized the tactic as deputy attorney general from 2003 to 2005, he believes it is torture and illegal. Do you believe in redemption? I do. I just find it fairly rare. Speaking of redemption, the guy who's running for comptroller of New York City, Eliot Spitzer, man, would I love to see him get that job. He's the guy that I think should have been president of the United States. Not because he patronized hookers. I know everybody. Quack, quack, quack. Obviously not because. But if you see this movie, Client Number 9, let me strongly, this is the expose movie. This is the movie that tells the story of how Eliot Spitzer got busted. You watch that movie and tell me that Eliot Spitzer shouldn't be president. But in any case, if he becomes the comptroller of New York City, he will be in a position to control that state's pension funds, which is billions of dollars. I think it's over $100 billion, which means that he will be able to say to big banksters and to big corporations, we're not going to put our money into your stock unless you do thus and so. I'd love to see it. Eliot Spitzer and Elizabeth Warren are kind of, you know, at least with regard to their economic policies, two peas in a pod. And I think either one of them would make a great president. But both of them would make a great Secretary of the Treasury. And in this case, he's running for basically the Secretary of the Treasury of the city of New York, which is a big deal. So we'll see how that plays out. Daryl in Ringgold, Georgia. Hey, Daryl, what's on your mind?
Hey. I just got a question that who's running this country? I know
the Koch brothers.
Man who just, yeah, yep, you're right. And basically, it seems to me that Obama has become a part of the problem. I mean,
I don't think he's become part of the problem, but as president, he doesn't have the power to be the solution. And the Supreme Court has made the situation far, far worse by saying that corporations are people and money is speech. So basically they can buy off any politician they want. To some extent, they've bought him off. I mean, the fact that he's out there hawking natural gas and nuclear power as being clean makes me crazy. On the other hand, he's a hell of a lot better than Mitt Romney. We shouldn't have to settle for the lesser of two evils or second best. I don't think he's the lesser of two evils. I don't think Obama is evil. He's just not a progressive. He's a middle-of-the-road Democrat, what used to be called a Nixon or an Eisenhower Republican, which ain't bad. It's just not what this country needs right now, frankly. And he has the ability. He has the knowledge of what this country needs. He used to talk like a progressive when he was a senator from Illinois, when he was running for the United States Senate from Illinois, and even arguably when he was running for president. And I'd like to see him take some of that language and start actually putting it into practice. Ned in DeQuincy, Louisiana. Hey, Ned, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
Say, look, I was just wanting to know if there's any way we, the citizenry of this country, can actually file suit against the Congress for malfeasance in office.
No.
Or they're ripping us off, Tom.
Yeah.
They're taking our money. They're not doing what they were hired to do.
Yeah,
and I just think that I see the people of Egypt. They just rose up and threw out the Morsi, the...
Yeah, but, you know, Ned, you would not want the United States Army to be taking over the United States, A. And B, keep in mind, Morsi was the first president elected in the 3,600-year history of Egypt. So they're very, very new at this. And they're going to be in for a rough patch here before they finally get it figured out. But back to the United States, the thing that we can do is we can basically impeach our members of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and you do that through something called an election. In 2014, in about, 13, 14 months from now, something like that, November of next year, we are going to have midterm elections in this United States, and every single member of the House of Representatives is up for reelection. Every single one. And what we need to make sure is that in the primaries, that good progressive Democrats are running, that there are good, solid Democratic candidates, and then in the general election that those people get elected. And that means that a lot of us have to get involved. A lot of us have to show up. The Republicans are doing their very best to make it very difficult for us with their voter suppression laws, with their gerrymandering, that now all these states are pushing through. They're shoving down people's throats as fast as they can now that the Supreme Court's given them the ability to. But, you know, beyond that, we really don't. You don't have the time for things like impeachment proceedings, and many states don't even have a mechanism for it. It's just, you know, it's elections, Ned. It's elections. One-third of the Senate is going to be up for reelection in a little more than a year, and all of the members of the House of Representatives are going to be up for reelection. And it's time to start getting organized right now. Gina in Apache Junction, Arizona. Hey, Gina, what's on your mind today?
I'm concerned about the Obama health care laws really having any effect, because it seems to me the corporations and the government has a way around it already. They just hire part-time. If it's less than 37 and a half hours, they don't have to pay health care at all. They don't have to provide it.
Right.
I have a friend in Sierra Vista, Arizona, who worked for the health care system for 19 and a half years. She was due up for her retirement plan in 20 years, and they put her on part-time, which negated her retirement plan and her health insurance that she had been provided.
Right.
After having had heart attacks and supplying her health insurance for her husband, who is ill.
Yeah, they have been doing this long before Obamacare. You are right, it will throw people off employer-mandated insurance and onto you can buy your own insurance. That's kind of the bad news. The good news is that if you're earning less than $84,000 a year, there's substantial government money to help you buy that insurance. And if you're earning less than $40,000 a year, basically the government will pay for all of it. So it's not, you know, the news isn't quite so bad as it sounds for people who are part-time, because typically they're not making that kind of money if they're part-time. But the other things that you point out, they are no longer eligible for pensions. They're typically no longer eligible for 401k matching funds. They're no longer eligible to accrue vacation or sick time, all kinds of things. You know, they lose a lot of rights as part-time workers. You have a lot of rights as full-time workers. So, Gina, this is just, you know, welcome to Republican America. You know, this is America being run of, by, and for the corporations. The unions had the power when they were a third of American workers before Reagan. Unions had the power to push back. Unions had the power to say, no, we're not going to do it that way. Unions had the power to say, you know, let's have some tariff laws that protect us, these kind of things. Now, after 32 years of Reaganomics, they've lost that power. We've lost most of our unions. CEO pay is through the roof. Average workers are screwed. And it's going to take a revolution in this country. And I'm not talking about one with guns. I'm talking about one at the ballot box, like the Reagan Revolution, like the FDR Revolution. It's going to take a revolution in this country to change the way things are. Gina, thank you for the call. Daryl in Port Orford, Oregon. Hey, Daryl, got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
All right, Tom. I moved out east with a family, close family friend, tried to get work. I ended up going to a day labor. Through the day labor, I ended up getting an everyday job. They liked my work ethic. I had supervisor training. That company offered me a job, and when they had went through the main office, come to find out that the day labor I worked for was getting like $16-$17 an hour, and they had it in their contract that they'd have to pay off the contract, continue paying the whole time I was there. So that kept me from getting a $14 an hour job where they straight paid me.
So wait a minute. You're saying that they were paying the temp help agency more than they were paying you, or you're saying that other people were being, I don't get it.
The temp agency was paying out minimum wage for me.
But they were being compensated at the rate of $15 or $16 an hour.
Yes, the company left.
Yeah, that's how temp help agencies make their money.
Company. Yeah, and they had offered me a job, and they couldn't do it because they had to continue paying that $16 an hour contract.
Yeah.
Building the
and this is the thing. More and more Americans are having to work for temp help agencies, and it just pushes another middleman another person in there to skim the piece off the top, and this is why American workers are screwed. Daryl, I'm sorry to hear your story.
You're
thank
listening
you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We live in Parasite America. We live in Predator America. It's where the largest corporations and the best scam artists make the most, and the workers are screwed. Welcome back. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service for the news of the day. This is Talk Radio News Report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.org. Goats for the Old Goat is Ellen Ratner's charity where they are helping freed slaves in South Sudan and the region around Darfur. It's really quite extraordinary. And Bob Ney on the line with us, former Congressman Bob Ney, working with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. I hope you are well.
I'm good.
It's always nice to hear your voice. What's going on in the world?
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is about to go nuclear.
You really believe he's going to do it this time?
Or nuclear, as Bush would say.
Right.
I think there's a chance he'll do it. And it would set a precedent, but it would be on nominations to break the filibusters, go back to the simple 51 votes. Of course, the Republicans say, well, if we get in the majority, look what we're going to do to you. Well, that's to be seen. They'll get in the majority.
Or they'll do it anyway.
They'll do it. Exactly. So I think this has a real chance. He's sending a message. Now, Comey, who's nominated for the FBI, that did sail through, really, today.
But he was a Republican, so you would expect
that. Yes, and everybody got their points in about whistleblowers, et cetera. So toughest question came from Senator Sessions, which really, honestly, wasn't a tough question about civilian or military courts. Right. But he was a Republican official, so this goes beyond Comey because people predicted some problem there, which I didn't think there would be.
Yeah.
But Harry Reid may invoke that option and go back to the simple 51 if the nominees are held up through filibusters.
Now, the way that he would do this is just by simply calling a vote of the Senate to change the rules of the Senate, and it would only require 51 votes to change the rules. Do I have that right?
Yes, it's a bit of a complicated process, which they call the nuclear option, but what would be unprecedented. It would be he would change the rules by 51 votes.
And, when it wasn't the beginning of a session.
Right. And there'll be several, he's got to go through some parliamentary wrangling, and he has to circumvent the 67-vote rule. And he can do that. It's just a whole parliamentary process. A little bit complicated. Bottom line is he can do it, though.
Right. So what sort of timeline do you see? When do you think he's going to do this? I mean, the Senate is the Senate in session this week?
The Senate's back.
They're back. So is he going to do it this week?
I don't think he'll do it this week. I think he's sending a message out there strong on the nominees if they continue to unfairly, mess, as they would say, on the Hill with the president's nominees. He'll invoke it, but I think he's pretty serious
about it. Well, he's been blocking some people for 6 years now, Bob.
Correct. And it's just uncalled for. You have a vote. You like him or you don't.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you up or down voted.
Yeah, and just so everybody is clear about this, we're not talking about a full nuclear option. This is sort of a limited nuclear option. It's still going to any piece of legislation is still going to have 60 votes in order to get passed if the Republicans choose to filibuster it, which they will, and which they routinely do everything. It's just that judgeships and nominees appointments to agencies that require the advice and consent of the Senate can now be appointed with 51 votes. There's 100 senators with a simple majority rather than be subject to the filibuster and thus have to have 60 votes.
Yes, that's correct. And the Republicans created in the minority years ago this convoluted system in the first place. A lot of people would like to see everything be simple majority 51 vote, but this would be limited nuclear option to the appointees.
Yeah, I would call it the constitutional option, which, by the way, is what the Republicans were trying to call it back when they wanted to do this during the Sam Alito nomination. Because the Constitution simply says a simple majority of the Senate is all it takes, for an appointment or for a law to pass.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay, what else is up?
Well, the other thing is Egypt. is the big picture. And we know now that $8 billion some is pouring in from Arab nations, which I think is viewed on the Hill as significant, that the Arab nations are going against basically the Muslim Brotherhood, which comes to the debate that you're starting to hear now with good Senator McCain about suspending our assistance to Egypt. Well, it just got $8 billion.
Yeah.
From its neighbors.
And these local countries, they're giving money to the official government of Egypt, so it's going to the military, which keeps putting up progressive and liberal nominees for prime minister. They tried al-Baradei. They just put up another guy. He was rejected by the Muslim Brotherhood, but does that mean that he's not going to get in, or does that mean that they're going to put him in over the objections of the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, I think the over the objections of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, a lot of things are going to be done. Of course, there was a brouhaha today about, you know, 51 of the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood that were killed by the military. Right. At the end of the day, four or five people supported the Muslim Brotherhood. Four or five people in Egypt now do not support them. And we can debate about a democracy and, you know, how the president went out, but he didn't act as a normal president would in a democracy.
Right.
But I think that, you know, the Arab nations, it shows a lot when they say, well, we're going to give money. And it's not going to go to the Muslim Brotherhood. You're right. It's going to the government, which will go into the military.
Right. So they've figured out that having a secular nation is to their benefit, basically, and rather than having a you know, in the United States, Morsi would be the equivalent of if Ralph Reed had been elected president of the United States and had appointed hardcore right-wing Christians to every single position and had changed the Constitution to say America was a Christian country. I mean, basically, that's what Morsi did there. He was a hard right-winger and a religious fanatic, and the people of Egypt said, no, thank you. We don't want Ralph Reed as our president.
Well, Ralph Reed got away with more than Morsi did, too.
As you well know, yes, and as you wrote about in your book.
Yes, sir.
I have a copy of it around here, but I don't have it right in front of me. The title, again, was?
Sideswipe.
Sideswipe. That's right. Thank you, Bob Nay.
You brought up Ralph Reed. I thought I'd ad-lib that.
Yes. Well, you have some very interesting Ralph Reed revelations in your book, Sideswiped, Bob Nay, and everybody should read it if they want to know what's going on in Washington, D.C. That is not a gratuitous plug. It's a genuine.
Thank you, sir.
To my reader, to my viewers and listeners. So that's interesting. Okay, we'll see. And that also means that it's less likely that what we're seeing is the beginning of a civil war in Egypt.
That's correct. The military, as long as this process continues where you have the, you know, what former Chief Justice we'd call him, is the temporary president, and they're going to open up the parliament, which opens up the elections in 2014, we can kind of wrangle and argue here, but within their own country, if they continue that path, I think they have a chance.
Right. So the Muslim Brotherhood, the last option that they're going to have basically is to mount an insurgency, probably a violent one. It seems that they've already tried that. But, I mean, you know, go full Iraq, roadside bombs and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Suicide bombings. And it wouldn't surprise me to see that. I mean, these guys are hardcore religious right-wingers, but hopefully not. Hopefully not. Okay. Bob Nay, his book, Sideswiped.
Thank
you, Bob. Thanks for being with us. And also, our Talk Radio News Service report today brought to you by GhostsForTheOldGoat.com. Thanks, Bob. Have a great day.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Debbie Hines on the line with us. She is a former trial lawyer. Former prosecutor, really knows her stuff, and a legal and political commentator over at LegalSpeaks.com, and has been keeping us up to date on what's going on in the George Zimmerman trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. Debbie, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be back.
Thank you. The thing that keeps haunting me about this, Debbie, is if you look at the people who are on death row in the United States, if you look at the people who are serving long-term sentences in the United States for violent crimes, and you look at the just raw statistics nationwide, although in some states it's far worse than others. By and large, when black people kill or attack white people, they go to jail or get killed. When white people kill or attack black people, they don't. And tell me if I'm just crazy here. I've had people call up and accuse me of being some sort of racist or reverse racist or whatever. But I am strongly of the opinion that if Trayvon Martin had been the guy who was following George Zimmerman and it had a gun in his holster, that virtually there wouldn't even be a trial. He would have been in jail, probably on death row, so fast it would make our heads spin.
Exactly, and that's the inherent bias of the system. I mean, and I actually have a blog on that. I don't know if you read it today, that basically is saying that if it were reversed and it was Trayvon Martin who had lived and George Zimmerman had died, this would be a whole nother story. There would not be any talk about whether we could get a conviction for second-degree murder, whether we could get a conviction for manslaughter,
right,
whether or not there is reasonable doubt. None of this would be in evidence. And that's why 40% of the jail population is African-Americans, although the African-American males, although they make up only 6% of the population.
Right.
The sad commentary on our society, and I have to agree with you.
Yeah, okay, so then that said, and if we're in agreement on that in both principle and practical terms, am I correct in my understanding that the white judge in this case has by and large said that issues of race may not be discussed?
She has said that in the opening statement that they could not say it was racially profiling. They could say it was profiling, but not racially profiling. And I'm not even clear why she said that. I mean, honestly, I think Deborah Nelson is an excellent judge, so I'm not going to distract or take away anything from her. I mean, she has moved the case along. She has done what she has had to do in terms of actually trying this case so that it didn't go on for 6 months. But I don't agree with a couple of her rulings, and that would be one of them.
Perhaps she was trying to reduce the probability or the possibility of an appeal or a successful appeal. I
don't think... maybe not so much as an appeal issue, because there was evidence of it. And in order to have an appellate issue, you have to have that there was, in this instance, that it wouldn't have been any proof of it. And they did have that. But maybe because she is from the area, she's trying to diffuse the whole racial issue.
Right.
Because judges are human, too. At the end of the day, judges are people. They're human also.
Right. I get it. Yeah, I get it. Sadly.
Yeah.
So I haven't watched the trial today. I've been on the air, and I've been doing show prep, and I did catch some of the snippets from yesterday. But bring us up to date on what's happened. It's been a couple days since you've been on our program.
Right.
Bring us up to date on what's going on.
Certainly. Well, we've had from the defense started their case on Friday in earnest, Friday afternoon, and from Friday and Monday, I just would call it Friends and Family Day. Mm-hmm. And what they had were basically friends and family, mom, uncle, friends, neighbors, who basically have supported George and know that the voice on the 911 tapes is George Zimmerman. How they know it, I don't know, but it's basically been the friends and family who are supporting him, who have given to his cause, who have bought the suit that he even had on in court yesterday, one of the witnesses testified to. And then today, we started to move more into the expert phase. And so what we had was a forensic pathologist from the defense side who says that from his review of Dr. Bale, the state's pathologist's report, and George Zimmerman's account of the report, that he concludes that everything happened the way George Zimmerman said it happened. That's, in essence, the bottom line for Dr. Bale, Dr. Mateo. But he is a prominent forensic pathologist, and he has testified in a lot of cases. Now, the prosecution was able to get some points in that this is also the person that testified in the Phil Spectrum case, and he also testified in the other cop case who had killed a couple of wives, and they didn't turn out so well. They turned out to be guilty verdict.
So we have a celebrity.
A little bit in about the fact that, just to get to the bias of the jurors, that this pathologist also believes in killing animals for research, and there are dog owners and animal owners on the jury.
Oh, that's interesting. So basically we have a celebrity testifier or whatever, a witness,
right,
a celebrity witness who's a pathologist. This is not the official state pathologist.
No. The official state pathologist, and my God, he had some issues with things that he testified to. So this is the defense forensic pathologist that they have called to counter what some of the things that Dr. Bale has said. So he's gotten into some specifics, such as that the gun could have been anywhere from 0.4 inches away to 4 feet away from Trayvon Martin. He's gotten in that he thinks that George Zimmerman was on the bottom, that Trayvon Martin was on the top. He's just gotten in a lot of things that basically counter everything that the state has said. I mean, he says, and I just find this unbelievable, that the injuries that George Zimmerman sustained to the back of his head, that those injuries were very severe injuries. And no one said that. Even the detectives who basically believed George Zimmerman's story didn't say that.
Right. They just put a bandage on it and said,
exactly.
Go home. Yeah, amazing. So, you know, I keep hearing from kind of professional commentators and people who know the law that this looks like it could be a toss-up, that probably there'll be a conviction on a lesser charge, manslaughter or some variation thereof, but that the second-degree murder bar, which requires proof of malicious intent, or, you know, the exact wording of that, is a tough bar to hop over, that the prosecution may not have done that.
Well, you know, the prosecution made some mistakes, but from the beginning, Tom, it was always a difficult case for second-degree murder. I mean, and you're talking about a second-degree murder case with all the variances and nuances that we're talking about, where the victim is black. When you're talking about that there is no one who actually saw what happened and you're having to really piece it together from all the different witnesses. And that's always makes out for a tough case. And the defense, to really be quite honest, they're putting on a pretty good case to kind of sort of diffuse. So it basically boils down to, who do you want to believe? Do you believe the state's witnesses or do you believe Zimmerman's witnesses? And the state has the burden of proof. But as to manslaughter, I definitely think that they can get a conviction on manslaughter. And I would be sorely disappointed if they were not able to up to this point. The trial is not finished. It is not over. But up to this point, of what I've heard, there's enough for them to get a conviction on manslaughter.
And if they got that, what might Zimmerman face?
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. I mean, everybody's concerned about whether it's second degree or manslaughter. Second degree carries a maximum of life in prison in the state of Florida, and manslaughter carries a maximum of 30 years.
Whoa.
But here's what I think is interesting, because up where I practice in Maryland and in this area, second degree carries a maximum of 30 years. So it doesn't matter as much to me what you call it, as long as hopefully with the evidence that the state puts on, that they'll be able to come forward and get that conviction.
Right. So if they got a conviction of manslaughter, Zimmerman could get 30 years in jail. And at his age, that could be damn close to life. I mean, that could be a large chunk of his life.
Exactly.
What are the who does the sentencing?
The judge.
Okay, very interesting. Debbie Hines, trial lawyer, former prosecutor, legal political commentator, her website, her blog over at LegalSpeaks.com. Brilliant stuff, great reading. Get over to LegalSpeaks.com and check it out. Debbie, thanks for dropping by again.
Oh, glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Always great talking to you.
Take care.
We will be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And more of your thoughts, my thoughts, of the opinions of the day, the news. And by the way, you think the prosecution's put on a good case here? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan in Phoenix, listening on 1480 AM. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to say that as we have the ongoing gun violence in this country, I am taking a dim view of our U.S. representatives and U.S. senators who are willing to accept contributions from corporations and organizations who are opposed to any type of gun ownership regulations. And the way I see it, they're accepting blood money.
Yeah, they're not just willing to accept it. They're out soliciting it. But, yeah, I agree with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And here we have these organizations that are willing to sacrifice the blood of our children just to prevent any kind of modification to their Second Amendment rights. And I find this to be unconscionable.
Well, and let's not call them Second Amendment rights, because the Second Amendment says that you have a right to have a well-regulated militia. And I don't see that happening.
Right. And I say this being a person that has not only been affected by the Newtown massacre, but also I knew people that were at the Gabby Giffords shooting. And that really affected me, too. I mean,
yeah.
I've got stories about that.
Yeah.
But I just want to say that I don't see how we can have this continue to go on. And I agree with you that we definitely need political activism. But I think the other side of it is that we need to call people out. In Arizona, we need to call out Senator Jeff Flake, who said he was going to vote for the background checks and then at the last minute turned his vote. And he was supposed to be a friend with Gabby and her husband, Mark.
Yep.
We need to call out Yeah, I mean, we talk about the Koch brothers. It sounds like another brand of coffee. It's David Koch and Charles Koch, and we need to say, hey, guys, come on the radio. Come on Tom's show. Come on Ring of Fire. Yeah. Tell us what you think.
They're worth $50 billion. They own the second largest privately held corporation in America. They don't give a rat's patootie about you and me.
Well, that's true. But what they do is they use their money to fund these other organizations like ALEC to do their dirty work.
Which will give them more power.
In my opinion, this is a form of cowardice. I don't care how they get their power. It's still cowardice.
Well, I'm not sure I would call them cowards. I think that they're actually brave has a particular connotation to it, but I lack a better word. I mean, these guys have at least the courage of their conviction. Charles Koch ran for president on the Libertarian ticket once. The Cato Institute was originally the Charles Koch Foundation. They have not been shy about who they are and what they're up to. Yes, they did, you know, fund a lot of stuff under the radar for decades, but now that it's totally out, they're quite out too. I think it's wrong that it's possible. I think the Supreme Court doctrine that has given them the ability to basically turn America into an oligarchy and control so much of our political process and basically buy states like Wisconsin, I think all of that is wrong. I think it's unconstitutional. I think it's anti-American. But what they are doing is legal, according to the Supreme Court. Go ahead.
They're willing to destroy the environment for all generations to come just so they can make a handsome profit in their short lifetime?
I think that's wrong.
This is unbelievable.
I think it's, you know, I absolutely think it's wrong, but at least they're upfront about it. There are a bunch of billionaires out there. I mean, like when the Walton family paid to come up with the phrase death tax and spent hundreds of millions of dollars to change the dialogue in America so that everybody was hysterical about the death tax and to cause average Americans to think that when they died, they were going to be subject to an inheritance tax, which simply isn't the case. They did that in secret. They ultimately got outed for that, but they tried to do that in secret. So you got a lot of billionaires who are funding a lot of stuff in the background in secret, a lot of this right-wing stuff. The Koch brothers, to their credit, I'm choking as I'm saying this, at least they're upfront about what they're doing. And perhaps there's a certain amount of hubris associated with that. Maybe they're, you know, thumbing their nose at us. I don't know. But at least we can see what's going on there. So, but, David, if you don't like it, the Koch brothers are not the rot at the center of our democracy. They are not the sin. They are the original sin. That is the U.S. Supreme Court's doctrine that billionaires' money is equal to and superior to your and my speech, that corporations that, you know, give billionaires their billions are persons and should have standing in the United States under, you know, and should have rights under the Constitution. And that is only going to be changed if we amend the Constitution, which is why I strongly suggest people go to movetoamend.org and start a local chapter and start raising some ruckus. Alan, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening there in Phoenix. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, you know, I guess I just wanted to talk about, you know, certain basic assumptions that we have in our society, like, for instance, competition. And we make the assumption that it's a good thing, and we project that onto our politics. I mean, you know, it comes from our worldview, I guess. But personally, I don't really, you know, I think competition is often a very destructive thing. It pushes people to do, actually quite hideous things to people, and it undermines other individuals. And, you know, not everyone can win. And I think I like, you know, a more cooperative society where it's kind of a win-win kind of thing. But I can't deny that a certain amount of competition does seem to spur people on maybe, you know, to do better. But I would call that stealing one another, like steal, like STELING. You know, it's not quite, you know, the same thing as, you know, just undermining the other person and throwing him under the bus and you know, you win.
Right.
And so, but the fact or the problem that I have is that it seems like so many people just naturally assume a very competitive kind of stance, and so maybe I'm just projecting my own.
Well, let me give you a metaphor and see if this makes sense to you. In a football game, it would be possible if there were not rules for one team to literally beat senseless somebody on another team, right? I mean, they could tackle in a way that would break somebody's neck. They could kill people. They could harm people. But we have rules to prevent that. That's a very competitive sport. But we have rules to keep that competition within rational boundaries so that people aren't hurt by it. Shouldn't we do the same thing for capitalism?
Absolutely. I agree with that. And I think, you know, it's so much part of how we do things. It's so jerky. I mean, we go from one extreme to the other.
I'm absolutely with you. But this is the problem with the libertarian Republican philosophy, is that there shouldn't be any rules to restrain competition, and there shouldn't be any rules to actually strengthen and help define the markets. And these are the same people who would love to have rules in a football game, but they don't want rules in the so-called free market, and it makes no sense. John, thanks for the call. Excellent, thought-provoking.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Regulated capitalism is what it's called, and it works. Laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated capitalism, is destructive. The good, the bad, and the very, very spursidically ugly. The good. Corey Kalanick, the California firefighter, is the talk of the town after CBS 47 in Fresno, California, aired this video of him saving a little kitten from a house fire last week. Check it out.
The kitten is limp as Corey Kalanick picks it up and takes it outside. He grabs a mask and an oxygen tank, setting the kitten on his glove to protect it from the hot asphalt.
On him, it went in a wet rag, bring him down a little bit. He's actually doing a lot better.
Pouring water on him and using an entire tank of oxygen, within 15 minutes, Kalanick massages life back into the tiny animal. It's affectionately nicknamed Lucky the Cat.
Good work, Corey. Your commitment to doing your job is just further proof that real heroism, you know, the kind that makes you feel all warm and fluffy like that kitten you saved, is not dead in America just yet. The bad. Liz Trotta. Conservatives say a lot of weird things about Obamacare, but what Fox News contributor Liz Trotta said about the law's birth control mandate during a Sunday appearance on America's news headquarters really takes the cake.
Such disregard is deeply rooted in the extraordinary creeping paganism that makes a mockery of the so-called separation between church and state, not to mention the president's very oath of office.
Yes, you heard her right. Paganism. Because, you know, one of the hidden purposes of Obamacare is to build a giant temple to Zeus. And the very, very ugly Glenn Beck. During a discussion on his radio show yesterday about Secretary of State John Kerry's whereabouts during the Egyptian crisis last week, the conservative pundit made some truly bizarre comments about the hospitalization of Secretary Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry. Check this out.
So he's definitely not on his boat until the pictures actually show up. And then, okay, he was on his boat. And you expect me to believe that Mrs. Ketchup is in critical condition? You've so violated our trust, I don't know what's real anymore. Because is this not the perfect scenario? He's on the... This is a huge scandal. And what do they say now? He is having a hard time. His wife is in the hospital. And that may very well be true, but I'm sorry. I can't give you any sympathy now because you've lied to us too many times.
Right, Glenn, right. This level of bizarre paranoia, or feigned paranoia for an audience, would actually be funny if it weren't just incredibly insensitive and very, very ugly. Maybe he was being... No, he wasn't. Okay, the trans-specific, I just want to throw this out, and then I'll go back to your calls here. It's Anything Goes Summer, after all. After Fukushima, after the nuclear power plants melted down in Japan, Germany, which had a couple of nuclear power plants of their own, said, that's it, no more. They were already well into their, you know, 100,000 solar panel roofs, whatever it was, program. So a company in Sweden that makes nuclear power plants is now suing Germany, saying, you can't do that. We're a corporation. And even though we're not a corporation in your country, Germany and Sweden have trade agreements through the EU, and we get to sue you. You can't have laws that hurt our companies. Bechtel Corporation sued Bolivia for undoing the privatization of its water supply. That was, you know, a couple of decades ago. I wrote about that in my book on equal protection. Corporations have already collected, this, by the way, from a post by Callie over on Democratic Underground titled Secret TPP Deal Would Void Democracy. Corporations have already collected $365 million by suing governments, usually in developing countries where the government doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of lawyers. And they're suing them under existing treaties. There's $13 billion more in suits standing before NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA tribunals in Central America and Peru. Consider this. In June 2012, the Egyptian government raised the minimum wage. A French company sued them, said, you can't raise your minimum wage. These are the kind of trade agreements that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the penultimate example of. The TPP, which is being negotiated in secret right now by the Obama administration, and they're trying to give it what's called fast-track authority, which means that it will be presented to Congress for an up or down vote, no amendments allowed, and no filibuster allowed. This should be considered a treaty, and it should require a two-thirds vote. But no, they're calling it an agreement, and they're trying to fast-track it. This will mean the end of democracy in America, officially, and the beginning of transnational. It's not just American corporations running the show here. It's going to be transnational corporations running the show. Welcome to the United States of Sony and Deutsche Bank and Samsung and, you know, fill in the blanks. This is not good. You may want to contact your member of Congress or call the White House comment line and share with them your opinion on whether we should have the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Trans-Atlantic variation thereof, which President Obama is pushing right now. Mark in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Oh, hi. So back in the early 80s, in the Reagan era, I was in school with I was going to City College in Chicago. I was friendly with this one defector from the Soviet Union who was also going to the same City College, and he was outraged at one little factoid that he found in his sociology text, and that was that Ronald Reagan in 1972 had an income of $2 million and paid no taxes.
Okay.
So
Mitt Romney made a whole lot more than that he probably paid no taxes on. But, yeah, I get it. This is, you know, welcome to the two Americas. You know, John Edwards is right. His sex life might have been pretty bizarre, but politically, John Edwards was right. We live in two Americas. There's one America for the wealthy and the powerful, the Ronald Reagans and the Mitt Romneys of the world and the Koch brothers of the world. And there's another America for average working people who, you know, instead of robbing a bank for hundreds of millions of dollars like rich people can do, if they rob a 7-Eleven and walk off with a candy bar or a can of soda, they get put in prison. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, before I point out one more hypocrisy to add to the dozens upon dozens we already have on the record, the Senate may not originate any legislation, but neither does the House of Representatives. It starts with Alec.
Yeah, you're right.
Ronald Reagan.
Actually, the Alec does pretty much exclusively state legislation, but you're right. It's happening all over the United States.
I didn't have Alzheimer's in my vocabulary back then. I referred to Ronald Reagan as being in the early stages of dementia.
Yeah.
And sure enough, turns out he was.
Yep.
But anyway, on this other hypocrisy, about Republicans pointing out how resources are unlimited and there's unlimited pie, always expanding for everybody. Except when the bottom 60% you advocate for higher wages, then all of a sudden the world is coming to an end and we can't afford to pay people what's equitable because the pie is expanding at the top only.
You're right. You're right. It's an excellent point. Yeah, a rising tide lifts all boats, but we can't have raised the minimum wage because that would rise everybody's tide. You can't have that. Excellent point, Johnny. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Shane in Palm Coast, Florida, and listening on Sirius Satellite XM. Hey, Shane, what's up?
Hey, love your show. I agree with you almost everything.
But?
Except the Second Amendment. Every time someone brings it up, you say it is not an individual right. It's a militia thing. And the Heller decision, didn't they clear that up?
Yeah, the Supreme Court has asserted that it is that there is an individual right to own a gun in the Constitution. However, they also said that that right is subject to regulation by the states. And, you know, I disagree that there is an individual right, but that's, you know, that's my right to disagree. They, however, are the ones who get to define what the laws are in this country. So I'm just a lonely talk show host out here.
Yeah, well, every time somebody brings up the Second Amendment right, you say no. There's not a Second Amendment right to own a gun.
Yeah, in my opinion.
Militia. It's a militia. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I never heard your opinion.
Okay. Well, I'll start trying to qualify it, Shane, because you're right.
I'm sorry. It just bugs me, but I love your show.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I have no problem being corrected when I'm wrong. Yeah, and you're right. Heller did decide that. Mary in Adams, Wisconsin. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hey, I got a question for you. First, I love your show.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing all this stuff to our attention. But, you know, as far as the revolution idea and nonviolent revolution, you know, they've used this internet to spy on us, okay? Why can't we use the internet to actually have a government by the people, for the people? Use the internet to vote on everything that the government does with our tax dollars.
Because if a small group of really smart, you know, teens and 20-somethings can literally hack the FBI and CIA's website, they could hack an election. I don't trust the internet enough to put our elections there. I agree with Bernie Sanders. We should go back to paper like most of the developed world does and not do the computers. I do think, though, I think you're making an excellent point, that we can use the internet as a tool of democracy by using it to spread small-d democratic messages and memes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We can also use it as a nexus for activism by joining activist groups. But, you know, the internet voting has been demonstrated to not be secure. It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And oh, there goes my mouse again. This time it's just misbehaving. Andrew, listening on Progressive Voices. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hello again. So something odd I noticed when I was I read the news about some Democrat who's running against a current Republican member of Congress. I noticed that Republican that Republican member of Congress was first elected in 1994. Didn't the Contract with America by Newt Gingrich promise to enact term limits for Congress members?
I don't remember if the Contract with America had term limits in it or not. I know that the members of Congress who were by and large elected during that sweep, term limits was a big part of their platform. Go ahead.
And the thing is that you got guys like Senator Jim Inhofe and Tom Coburn. They were first elected in 1994, and they're still in office. I just want to know why so many Republicans who ran in 1994 never followed their own dictated term limits. I mean, you even got Mark Stanford in here in Congress, even though despite the Appalachian Trail thing.
Yeah. Well, it's because they know the term limits is a stupid idea, A. And B, if you look up hypocrite in the dictionary, it says C, Republican. If you look up Republican, it says C, hypocrite. You know, it's pretty straightforward process. Andrew, thanks for the call. Bill, also listening on Progressive Voices in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you. Longtime listener. Your comments earlier about deregulation and the need for rules reminded me of a point I've been trying to make to people for years, is that when the banks were bailed out with TARP, and they were told, okay, now that we've given you all this money back, we need to start loaning the money out again. And they basically refused to, saying that there was still too much uncertainty in the market.
That's correct.
And to that I say, of course there's still too much uncertainty in the market because you're deregulated.
Yep.
With deregulation, you don't know what the other guys out there are going to do that might crash the economy again.
Yep.
Deregulation creates uncertainty. Regulation creates stability.
Yeah, deregulation is like having a football game with no referees, and you've got some guys on the team who are like, you know, I'm not sure I want to go out there because that rule that you can't have a shiv, you know, hidden in your boot, that rule is not being enforced.
That's another example of the hypocrisy. They want the deregulation, but they don't want the uncertainty.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, just for the record, In September of 2008, the Republicans, the banks said, please bail us out. And the Republicans passed TARP, and they handed a large quantity of money off to the banks. And then in October, just 4 weeks later, the banks came back and said, that wasn't enough money. Give us more money. And the Republicans all voted for more money. There were two TARPs under George Bush. And in both cases, they just gave hundreds of millions, billions of dollars to the banksters while the Fed was giving them trillions of dollars. And Congress had no problem passing that. Republicans in Congress had no problem passing that. Although today they won't pass anything, even simple stuff like, hey, you know, let's just reauthorize food stamps. In fact, just today, John Boehner said, you know, in the farm bill, we're going to decouple all the money that goes to the big ag corporations, the big farm subsidies, from the food stamps, so we can pass the subsidies to the rich guys and the farm, you know, the rich agribusiness companies, without passing the legislation that reauthorizes and refunds, again funds the food stamp program. We can have a debate on that. Right. Bill, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Harold in Broomfield, Colorado. Hey, Harold, what's up?
Tom, I was just hearing your comments there, and I heard about the labor. And basically, we already have a fascist government as it is, from what I understand. The lobbyists are the one making the laws for Congress because Congress is so busy and they don't know what to write. So how are we going to correct that kind of situation?
You pass a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not law, and Congress has the authority to pass laws enforcing this. And then Congress will pass laws saying, you know, putting limits on campaign contributions, strengthening public funding for campaigns, and putting limits on the ability of lobbyists to behave like we used to have. I mean, when Reagan came into office, there were only a few hundred lobbyists in this town. Now there's tens of thousands, over 30,000 of them, and they start, you know, starting salary for lobbyists in this town as a grunt is $160,000. As a former member of Congress is $500,000 to $1 million. As a former senator is $3 to $5 million. And all of that has been because of the Supreme Court. I'm convinced, Harold, that even most Republicans would vote for and create McCain-Feingold-style legislation. And keep in mind, McCain was a Republican. Style legislation that would regulate money in politics if they could, because even Republicans find distasteful the idea that 6 hours out of the day they have to go rent an office someplace, even if it's a plush office over at Heritage Foundation or a little less plush office in some of the other office places around here that the Democrats tend to use, to dial for dollars, because both Republicans and Democrats are dialing for dollars. It's a tragedy. So I think that could be done, and I think it would work. Harold, thanks for the call. Marie in Henderson, Nevada, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Marie, what's up? We have just a minute to the end of the hour. It's all yours.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Well, I wanted to tell you about the minimum wage. The reason why the Republicans want to keep it low is because each time they keep the minimum wage low, they depress every other professional wage out there.
You're right.
So the guy who's making $14 an hour, he thinks he's doing good because he's making double the minimum wage, but actually he's just trying to keep up with the cost of living.
Yep.
You're
absolutely right.
That's what it is. I mean, the science of minimum wage is that it's not the amount of money, it's what it can buy with those money. And the minimum wage is the bare necessity, actually, that people should be able to purchase by
You're absolutely right. And here we have the Fed coming out today, or at least the Chicago Fed, one of the feds coming out today and saying, $50 billion in increased economic activity. Huge stimulus if we simply raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, as the president has asked for. Coming up tomorrow, why do right-wingers think diplomacy to prevent war is a sign of weakness? I'll challenge Discovery Institute senior fellow John Wohlstetter, author of the new book Sleepwalking with the Bomb. And don't forget, democracy requires your activity. Find a progressive activist group. There's many of them out there, great organizations. Get involved or get inside the Democratic Party. Say, we're going to take this thing over. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.